All right, so we're beginning a four-week class here on idolatry. And we're going to begin just by asking the question this morning, what is idolatry? Worshiping something instead of God. That's a very succinct, and I think that what you're saying gets at the breadth of the topic, right? There's a lot of different things that idolatry covers. You said something that is not God. What does that involve? Like anything, right?
Right.
Yeah. Other thoughts on idolatry? These are some idols, by the way, that we've dug up in the ancient Near East.
It doesn't have to be physical. It can be like success or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah, so it's not confined to simply a physical object, right? Here's a painting of that's the golden calf. Some, you know, artistic license taken as it's floating in the air or whatever. But yeah, that's sometimes what we think of, right? These physical objects. But as you're getting at, there's this larger reality behind that. Other thoughts?
You can do something good.
Mm-hmm.
This is easy. Something bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great observation. Good things with an inordinate amount of affection attached to them become idols, right? Because they get in the way of God. How much do you think about idolatry?
Not very much.
Not very much? Yeah. I think that's, we're just, and I think some of it is we still have a view of idolatry that is very connected to those little stone statue things, right? That's sort of our predisposition to think of idolatry as something like that, and therefore it's not as central. But as we'll see as we go through the Old Testament, in a sense, it's not, some people would argue it's the sin, right, that runs through the Old Testament. People become idolaters very quickly and at very key moments throughout the biblical narrative. It doesn't take long for God's people to say, hey, God, what you're doing is not the best way. I'm going to do something else. We see that even, you know, Joshua chapter 2, as God's people are getting to the promised land, very quickly, they're idolaters, right? This picture, right? God's just brought them out of the promised land. They're idolaters. Why did they go into exile? Because they were idolaters, right? And so we see this rhythm again and again. And as we'll see today, as we look at some New Testament texts, it doesn't just stay in the Old Testament. There's plenty of New Testament idolatry going on as well. All right, so let's look at a couple definitions of idolatry. We had one from one brave soul. Anyone else want to define idolatry before we look at some formal definitions? All right, here's three. What is idolatry? In its most basic sense, idolatry is just worshiping something that isn't God, worshiping something in the creation instead of the creator. But I'm going to go through a few of these by a few different authors. We'll start on this side and work that way. This is by a Catholic scholar named William T. Kavanaugh. He says, idolatry is not so much a metaphysical error as it is a misplaced loyalty. Idolatry is about behavior, not simply belief, right? And so that's a very key distinction, that it's about behavior, not simply belief, because sometimes we think, well, how foolish could somebody be to believe in an idol, right? Even when maybe you've had that encounter reading through Exodus, and you're like, come on, people, why are you worshiping these stones, right? And that's even how the Bible sometimes treats it. Isaiah 44, Isaiah 44, we'll stick with that text. The other one's 10, but I can't remember which book it's in. Treats it very foolishly, right? Like, how could you be so foolish to do this? And we'll explain why that's the case, but it's very much not simply about belief, but also behavior. Then this guy named Habertal, he's a Jewish scholar. He says this, idolatry is a sin of interpersonal relationship, analogous to betrayal and disloyalty. It is rooted in forgetfulness of what God has done. Fidelity is rooted in remembering. And so that's a very key component. God's people become idolaters. We become idolaters when we forget what God has done for us. And then in maybe the more popular kind of language, Tim Keller puts it this way, an idol is anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give you. And there, Ace, that's kind of your idea, your contribution there of it being a good thing right, that can become sort of too large in our lives. Other thoughts as you look at these definitions? What do you notice? Where does this maybe expand your understanding of idolatry?
Wouldn't you say the root of all sin is idolatry?
I think so. I think I'm comfortable saying that. Yeah. Because idolatry is fundamentally putting something else in God's place, right? And it's also why we'll look at Exodus 20, right? Ten Commandments. It begins with idolatry. And arguably that sets the tone for everything that follows. And we see that even later on, we'll get to Colossians 3, verse 5, where it says that greed is idolatry, right? And so it really is an expansive category, and it begins with moving God out of his rightful place. And once that's out of line, then the host of sins kind of follows through.
I think it's interesting that middle definition mm-hmm. by the Jewish scholar it reminds me of the Old Testament, where the Hebrews are constantly being told to remember the God that led them out of mm-hmm. Egypt mm-hmm. and not to forget what he had done for them. Yeah. So to say that idolatry is rooted in forgetfulness of what God has done, fidelity is rooted in remembering. Mm-hmm. Seems like a very Jewish message that we get.
Yeah, no, I very much agree with that. And that, I think, is an encouragement to us, too, right? I mean, that dynamic plays out now. We become idolaters when we forget God's goodness to us, right? When we confront a new situation, we say, I don't know if God can get me through this. And that's usually sort of the existential crisis of God's people, right? It's, we're now in the wilderness. This is new. How's God going to get me through this? Let's get an idol, right? And that's a... And we'll explain it, we'll get it to, in a moment, we'll get to sort of why that made sense to them, but we do the same thing, right? We get to an existential crisis, we're in the wilderness metaphorically, so to speak, and we say, you know, I don't know how God's going to do this, therefore I need to rely on something more significant than God in my mind. That's how idolatry sort of functions on a heart level.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of wonder how pride, mm-hmm. you know, fits in, because... You know, are we thinking, well, I got to take action, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Like Abraham and Sarah. It's yeah. like, okay, you know.
Push comes to shove, I got to do this.
I got to do this, yeah. So it's kind of interesting just what the, correlation is mm-hmm. between pride and idolatry. Is idolatry first and then pride comes mm-hmm. in? I don't know. It's just kind of.
Yeah. They're very much interrelated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I think more about pride than I do idolatry. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. then I'm kind of like, ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's interesting. So there's a few scholars, when they look at idolatry, Augustine being one of them, he defines it as self-love, which is pride. Mm-hmm. So there's a very much a correlate. It's sort of saying my sufficiency, right? Mm-hmm. What I need is better, therefore I'm going to go to this idol because it looks better to me. Then fast forward from Augustine to French philosopher about 100 years ago, talked about idolatry as a mirror, mm-hmm. that what we worship in an idolatrous way reflects our own sort of warped nature. Mm-hmm. So all of those things are kind of getting at what you're describing there in terms of pride. Other thoughts on these definitions? We kind of get it. And I hope, I mean, as we talk about idolatry, I hope we'll get to some hope, maybe not today, other weeks, but there's a hopefulness that I think that can come through this conversation too, right? We're not condemned to be idolaters. There is hope. Even as the New Testament will warn us about idolatry, it always brings us back to the goodness of the gospel that frees us from idolatry. All right. David Foster Wallace, this is somewhat maybe overquoted in different places, but he gave a speech. If you know David Foster Wallace, he's this, was a novelist, just really brilliant kind of thinker, not a Christian, but one of those people that sees the world so well that some of the things he says almost sound Christian. But he gave this as a commencement address back in 2005. There's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. Pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. And the things he intersperses there is sort of, he does point to sort of God and just various religious expressions. So he's not getting all the way there. But that last phrase, I think, is really helpful for us. Anything else will eat you alive. That's perceptive, right? If we're not worshiping correctly, it eats us alive. These idols are a manifestation of pseudo-goodness in our minds. And as we go towards them, they demand everything from us. They always want more, and so they eat us alive. And I think we can all resonate that. I don't know if you have a list of idols that you carry with you, but your own personal idols. We'll see that, I think, actually in the passage this week, where there are household idols, right? These terrapins that they would have around, like sort of your household gods. These are the ones that we hold on to. And if you think about it for maybe more than 30 seconds, you might be able to identify some of them in your own household, the ones that you carry around.
Did you say this person was not a believer?
Correct.
And yet his last phrase is contradictory. Yep. Was he talking about anything else you worship if he's not a believer?
The point is everybody worships something. The point is we are hardwired to worship.
Okay.
And so he needs to worship valuable things. And so he's adjacent to Christianity. His biography is very complicated.
I just wonder what he meant by anything else. You have to have a primary thing that you worship.
Well, anything else other than, so this is a truncated quote, anything else here, he's compared it to sort of, he's pointed to sort of worshiping God or sort of some sort of religion. He's pointing towards religion generally, yeah. But the point is, we all worship. The question is, are we going to worship the right thing? Carrying on, we are imaging creatures. Our very nature is to, God created us, right, in the image of God to reflect something. And so there's a lot of books that talk about this, but maybe one of the most helpful ones, I was going to bring copies if anybody wanted one. It's by this guy, J.K. Beale. He says, we become what we worship. And that's really the point of his thing. Not that we literally become idols, but he goes into this argument really from Isaiah 6. He's got a complicated thing. We'll see it from Psalm 115 in a minute. But that as we worship idols, we become like them. The Old Testament logic is as you worship idols, an idol is speechless and can't hear. And as we do that, as we worship idols, we become speechless and unable to hear, specifically unable to hear God. That's the logic that he's saying. And so the reality is, as humans, we are created to image God, but if we worship idolatry, we image idols. We become like them in terms of our dumbness and our muteness. We become less than we should be, is sort of the logic that Beale, and we'll see. I'm kind of front-ending. I was going to do the Bible verses first, but I'm going to front-end some of this, and then we'll get into a bunch of Bible verses in the last half an hour. Interestingly, and I know we're just kind of throwing a lot of stuff out this morning, so the Jewish community, as they talked about idolatry, within the Old Testament, idolatry, the word translated, just means worshiping foreign gods. But the Talmud, which is sort of the Jewish commentary that sort of accompanies the Old Testament, they use this term called strange worship. That's what they call idolatry. Like a strange perversion, like an alternate sort of worship. And that's an interesting way of thinking about it. It is worship, but it is strange. Even the connection to Nadab and Abihu offered strange fire before the Lord, unauthorized, inappropriate. Those are all words we could put around there. And so the question for us as we do this is, how are we going to image properly? And we'll talk about that in a moment. I'm going to skip this. Why would somebody, I'm going to reverse these. Why would somebody want to be an idolater, right? Who wakes up Tuesday morning in ancient Israel and says, today is a good day to be an idolater, right? we started with that little picture of the stone images, and it's like, well, that's kind of foolish. Nobody's going to wake up and say, we have this stone or we have this great living God to worship. Which one should we choose? And they take a family vote and they say, no, we're going to go with the statue today. Like, you know, that's sometimes how we think about this. These, I think there's eight of them up here. These come from Douglas Stewart in his Exodus commentary. And he asked that question. And it's helpful for us to kind of get this in our minds. But these are the advantages of worshiping idols, if you're an ancient Near Eastern person. And then we'll translate it in today. So let's work through them quickly. It's guaranteed, as in offer the right sacrifices and the right stuff comes. That's sort of the way they operate. And part of us hears that and says, well, but does that work? They are sitting, God's people are sitting right in the middle of other nations that in some ways seem bigger and more powerful than them, right? God sends the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. They have stuff. They've got cities. They've got Goliath. They've got all these things that look powerful. And so just in the same way, if you've ever sat in your house and you looked at your neighbor who's not a believer, and you're like, man, they have it easier than me. Their kids are more successful than my kids. Their, you know, car is nicer than my car. Their bank account's fatter than my bank account. And here I am faithfully worshiping God, and they're an idolater. Maybe you haven't phrased it in that way, but that's sort of the logic. And so sometimes ancient Near Eastern people, like the Israelites, would look at the Philistines next door and say, let's just do what they're doing, because it seems to be working. So that's some of the implicit logic of why somebody would be an idolater. Selfish. The gods needed human beings to feed them, so you could get what you want by bringing the right sacrifice. Sort of there's no sacrificialness, it's just transactional, right? It makes some sense. It's easy and convenient, right? These idols don't actually demand nearly as much of you as Yahweh does, right? Yes, there are rules, there are some guidance in the religion, but none of the other religions in the time are as prescriptive on what you do with your pots and pans and how you cook your food and all these sorts of things, right? So it's a little easier just to do what the other people are doing. And so along with this, some of these are sort of coextensive, but it's normal and logical. Everyone's doing it, makes sense. And so let's sort of, you go to your specific deity. If your goat's not having babies, you've got a god to go to for that, right? So go to the specialist. And along with that, it's pleasing and indulgence. Idolatry involved elaborate sacrifices and feastings and a lot of sexual activity joined with a worship of the idol. And so all of those things sort of made it somewhat attractive to go and be an idolater. And so if we translate to today, we did that a little bit. I think it makes sense to, you know, if our idols are pride and success and comfort and money and sex and all those sorts of things, it sort of makes sense to sort of say, hey, those things are good things. Let's enjoy them. Everybody else is. And so that's some of the implicit logic of why you would be an idolater. Thoughts here?
Sounds like the prosperity gospel.
Yeah. And yeah, the prosperity gospel for sure. And I think there's also a part of it that just sounds like normal life, right? Just like a normal American living. Just kind of go and do it, and it works well, right? And that's hard for us to sometimes untangle that, because that means sometimes, you know, being faithful and not being an idolater will mean having less, potentially. Or it won't, you know, just because we didn't worship idols doesn't mean we won't suffer. And those sort of are some of the points that we struggle with. Other thoughts here?
Any of those things, whatever would fill the void, is what you would call it, or, you know, call your eye.
Yeah. All right. So one other thing, and this is less spiritual, but I think it's a helpful piece of the puzzle piecing together how people thought about idolatry. Like just thinking about it logically, like going towards this tiny icon type thing and bowing before it and giving it stuff. That seems a little bit foreign to us. But the folks that did this were a little more sophisticated than that. On the right here, this is an engraving of the process that's described in the words. But they had this ceremony called a mouthwashing ceremony. We can read about it. There's sort of texts that describe it. And it was pretty widely used. So when you make an idol, it takes 2 days and seven steps for the god to come and reside in the idol. So the craftsman who makes the idol isn't just sort of saying, hey, I made some idols, come buy one. To be a licensed idol maker, quite literally, you would have to have a shop of some repute that was connected to a cultic center like a temple, and you would have to sort of have put your idols through the process to get the divine presence to dwell in the idol. So I say this just to say they were a little more sophisticated than like we're worshiping rocks. They're worshiping rocks that had gone through something. And so, yeah, it's this back and forth of like gathering the materials and sort of setting them aside and having them sort of consecrated, so to speak. And then it culminates with the mouth washing or opening of the mouth ceremonies that sort of purify the deity. And right here at the bottom, I know this is small, but this is between steps 6 and 7 of the process, where the craftsman says, I did not create the statue. It was the craftsman god, the text is obscured, who created the statue. And so there's this awareness that that thing isn't capable of being divine without something happening. And so the idol then sort of becomes an access point to the divine. And so there's, yeah, we could go into a lot of the detail there, but I think that's a helpful piece of the puzzle. Now, as we get to some biblical text, we'll see that Isaiah 44, 9 and following will kind of describe that process and still mock it appropriately. It's like, it doesn't matter what you do, it's still a rock. But sort of in terms of the way people thought about it, it had a little bit more complexity to it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Worth knowing. Because I think, and I'm not overstating this, but I think sometimes we dismiss idolatry as just plain foolishness, and which it is. But by doing that, we can negate its power, right? You want to know that idolatry is actually a real threat to you. And so when Isaiah will go and mock idolatry, it's appropriately saying, this is foolish, don't do it. Sometimes New Testament believers hear that and says, how stupid was everybody, right? They worshiped idols, right? And that is what you're supposed to say, but you're also supposed to say, oh yeah, my tendency to want to worship something other than God is so foolish that it's like that.
I got a question.
Yeah.
If the gods dwelt in the stone,
yeah,
our God dwelt in the tabernacle and in the temple, mm-hmm. So is that a form of idolatry?
Great distinction. So Exodus 20, right? So we're not supposed to make any images of Yahweh. And part of the logic of that from an ancient Near Eastern mind is that Deuteronomy 6, God is one, right? He cannot be fragmented, right? And this process was a fragmentation of the God putting him all these things. Now, why does Yahweh not need that? Because he already has image bearers. That's you and I, right? Whereas these ancient Near Eastern people, the only image bearer would be the king or that sort of thing. And so you need to sort of set up his image everywhere. God doesn't need idols, as in little images of himself, because he already does. It's us. Yeah. It's a great question. All right. That's how idolatry is attractive. Let's start just working through some text to kind of begin seeing where this comes together. So let's go to Exodus chapter 20. Ten Commandments, and we'll be bouncing quickly through some of these texts. So Exodus 20 begins, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. All right, let's stop there. So going back to that definition of remembering and idolatry, right? It begins with saying, remember what happened. I am the God who brought you out of Egypt. The prologue there is very important. And then next, you shall have no other gods before me or besides me. It's not implying that there are other gods right up there. At this time, it was, people were okay with having, you know, add a god into the group, add a god to your pantheon. This isn't sort of, and that's called monolatry, where you sort of have a chief god and a bunch of gods underneath. This is very much saying there is a sole only God. And verse 4, you shall not make for yourselves a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. You shall not bow before them or serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. And so there's the sort of baseline. Idolatry is not what we do, and it's anchored in who God is. It's not just sort of, I'm the best God. It's, no, I'm the God who brought you up out of Egypt. That is why you cannot do this. And so then it says, right, verse 4, the second command there of not making any images, it's clearly not indicating, there's a worship component behind that, right? As it gets down to, you shall not bow to them. There were images of things in the tabernacle, right? Different sort of plants and other things were imaged there. But the point here is there's no veneration of those things. God alone is the one who is God. Luther's catechism on this says, whatever your heart clings to and relies upon, that is your God. Trust and faith of the heart alone make both God and idol. So getting to that response towards who God is. All right, that's a pretty, we're familiar with that passage, but we need to start there. Any thoughts on that Exodus passage?
So any worship of anything other than the true God is idolatry. Mm-hmm. So we would say that those that worship God if it's not the true God that they're worshiping, the God of the Bible, but another version mm-hmm. of that God. Mm-hmm. I think there's some about cults, about Islam, all those, there's lots of cultic type of beliefs in God, but then it's not the true God because they've added other things to it.
Correct.
But all that would be all under idolatry.
So it's a huge category. Yeah, it would involve all of that for sure. All right. Any other thoughts on Exodus 20?
Well, just the when we studied this, you know, the Israelites were coming out of the 400 and some odd years in Egypt, and so they were steeped in all those different gods. So he's you know, working on getting their thinking correct.
Yeah.
Giving them a biblical worldview.
Yeah. That's interesting because and we'll see this. The early church has the same reality as they bring people in Acts, right? I think it's Acts 15:20. One of the only real stipulations that they put on new believers, one of them is that they don't worship idols. And I think it's, again, I think what you're highlighting is there's this through line of everybody's worshiping something, right? So if we become a Christian, we come out of something that worshiped something. Whether it was just our success or just the American dream or whatever, we were worshiping that. And so I think that the same prohibition comes in as we are believers now. It's still the don't be an idolater, right? It's not just these unique points in time. That's that dynamic of coming out of a culture, because this is maybe getting too far afield, but cultures, some would argue, are almost defined by idolatry. Cultures organize around idols. And so if we become a Christian, we are by definition, becoming countercultural because we're not worshiping what everybody else is anymore. And that's going to create opposition and a different way of living. All right, let's go to Isaiah 44 and verse 9. This is a fun passage. I'm going to read all the way to verse 20. All you who fashion idols are nothing, and the things they delight in do not profit. Their witnesses neither see nor know, that they may be put to shame. Who fashions a god or casts an idol that is profitable for nothing? Behold, all his companions shall be put to shame, and the craftsmen are only human. Let them all assemble. Let them stand forth. They shall be terrified. They shall be put to shame together. The ironsmith, makes a cutting tool and works it over the coals. He fashions it with hammers and works it with his strong arm. He becomes hungry and his strength fails. He drinks no water and is faint. The carpenter stretches a line. He marks it out with a pencil. He shapes it with planes and marks it with a compass. He shapes it with the figure of a man, with the beauty of a man, to dwell in a house. He cuts down cedars, or he chooses a cypress tree or an oak and lets it grow strong among the trees of the forest. He plants a cedar, and the rain nourishes it. Then it becomes fuel for a man. He takes a part of it and warms himself. He kindles a fire and bakes bread. He makes a god and worships it. He makes it an idol and falls down before it. Half of it burns in the fire. Over the half, he eats meat. He roasts it and is satisfied. Also, he warms himself and says, I am warm. I have seen the fire. And the rest of it he makes into an idol, his idol, and falls down to it and worships it. He prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They know not, nor do they discern, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so they cannot understand. No one considers, nor is there knowledge or discernment to say, half of it is burned in the fire. I also baked bread on its coals. I roasted meat and I've eaten. And shall I make the rest of it into an abomination? Shall I fall before a block of wood? He feeds on ashes. A deluded heart has led me astray, and he cannot deliver himself or say, is there not a lie in my right hand? So that's a very sarcastic, appropriately. It's mocking. It's all of that. It's a fun passage, right? I think especially if you read that with a child, they're going to laugh, right? It's sort of funny. It's supposed to be. So what do we do with a passage like that? Throw it in the fire. Yeah, throw your idols in the fire. Other thoughts, things you noticed in that reading?
Well, when he said he makes an image like man, it's almost like that's worshiping yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's reflective of man. Yeah, and God does not have a body like man, right? And so that's a good observation. So we all agree, right? It's sort of funny. You know, you take the tree and half of it you're using for common use and the other part you're sort of venerating in this way. Remembering what we read earlier, right? That they did have a more sophisticated understanding. They would have said, yes, but I did the mouth-washing ritual on that piece of wood, right? That would be the counter-argument, so to speak. And yet, Isaiah is not ignorant of the mouth-washing ritual. He knows that they would have done that. And he says, still at its core, that doesn't do anything, right? It's still just material reality, worshiping the creation rather than the creator. How do we apply this today? It's a little... You know, we got to be a little careful. I think it might be too strong to sort of just sub in 401k for idol. You could try reading it that way, and it would actually have some application. But what's difficult about those applications is 401ks are not bad, right? Making them your ultimate meaning is bad, right? And so that's where there's a little bit of some things to think through as we apply it together, but that's the direction I think we need to go. And that line, and I mean this very, I don't mean this in a sort of nebulous way, but the line between an inordinate value in something and an appropriate value in something can be hard to determine, right? Are you valuing it too much, or are you appropriately valuing your family, your comfort, right? Or are those things inordinately involved? And maybe as we keep going, we'll see some clues. Maybe I think in Psalm 115, we'll start to see some clues and maybe how to make that distinguishing line between it becoming an inordinate desire or just an appropriate one. Other thoughts on this passage? Things you like or noticed?
Well, he spends time building it, so he's working on...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's doing all sorts of design and construction.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah, he's using craftsmanship, right? Yeah.
building the perfect beast.
Yeah.
Well, and I know this is a good sucker. It shapes it into the figure of a man with the beauty of a man. And so, I mean, you know, we can get zeroed in on health and fitness and looking perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You got to have the balance, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Again, taking care of our bodies.
Yeah.
Wise, biblical, yeah. All those kind of things.
Yeah.
But that can become an inordinate. And that's maybe why it's harder to see all of our idolatry, because it's also hard for us to be self-aware enough to say, yes, this has become an inordinately large thing in my life. And even maybe to back up a little bit, even before it becomes full-blown idolatry, it may become a distraction, right? And that's sort of where we need to be careful. Let's go to Jeremiah. This is a similar passage. Jeremiah 10, and we'll start in verse 1. Idols in the living God. Hear the word of the Lord that speaks to you, O house of Israel. Thus says the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, nor be dismayed by the signs of the heavens, because the nations are dismayed at them. For the customs of the people are vanity. So I think that's a really helpful way of phrasing it. It's reminding us that as people who follow God, we are positioned around nations, people that are different than us, that do certain things that we want to do. And that's often where idolatry comes about. Verse 3, or we saw that. For the customs of the people are vanity. Verse 4, in verse 3. A tree from the forest is cut down and worked with an axe by the hands of the craftsman. They decorate it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails so that it cannot move. Their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field, and they cannot speak. They have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Do not be afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither is it in them to do good. There is none like you, O Lord. You are great, and your name is great in might. Who would not fear you, O King of the nations? For this is your due. For among all the wise ones of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like you. They are both stupid and foolish. The instruction of idols is but wood. Beaten silver is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz. They are work of craftsmen and of the hands of the goldsmith. Their clothing is violet and purple. They are all the work of skilled men. But the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and the everlasting King. And at his wrath, the earth quakes, and the nations cannot endure his indignation. It's not there. So you see the same logic that we saw in Isaiah 44 of this sort of mocking of idols, this time set very much in terms of what the nations are doing and an attraction to that, a fear of that, some sort of sense of, well, they seem to be doing well, so I should maybe follow what they are doing. I love verse 5. Their idols are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. Just a great off-the-cuff insult. Like, you're just worshiping scarecrows and cucumber fields. And maybe we need to talk about our idols with that degree of boldness. Like, to tell, and I know I just keep harping on 401ks. Again, 401ks are good. You should have a 401k. All of those things. But if that becomes, like, your defining issue, then your life is built on cucumbers and scarecrows. Like, that's... What if we started talking that way to each other? Do you think we should? Again, with all the proper caveats and financial planning in place.
And I think it depends on how much that rules your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. First thing in the morning I see you, and the first thing I ask is, how's your 401k doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was great.
It's great.
How was yours?
Yeah.
And what are you invested in?
Yeah.
If that's all you talk about,
mm-hmm. Those are good indicators that this is becoming dominant. And also in our conversation is a great one, and then in our thoughts. Like, what do you think about when you have some space to think about? Is it running, you know, financial scenarios? Is it something else? Is it sports? Is it, you know, we can go down the list of things that could be sort of the dominant things. We could look at the Habakkuk passage there, but it just sort of stresses the speechlessness of idols. Let's go to Psalm 115. I think this is a key passage. We've seen sort of highlighted in those last two passages the fact that idols are dumb in terms of they can't speak. They are witless. They have no capacity for any of that. And so Psalm 115 begins to give us sort of the results. So if you're an idolater, what happens? Verse 4 repeats what we've heard before. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths but do not speak, eyes but do not see. They have ears but do not hear, noses but do not smell. They have hands but do not feel, feet but do not walk, and they do not make a sound in their throat. Here's the kicker. Those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them. Now, what's he saying there? In one level, and we'll see this if we walk through all of Isaiah, you can see this more clearly. As we worship idols, part of God's punishment on that is sort of closing our ears, his judgment that we can't hear. But even more fully, I think there's a reality if we go back to what we're called to be as image bearers, right? We're called to image God and represent him in sort of the flourishing of humanity. But when we worship an idol, we begin imaging that idol and we become less reflective of God's full plan for humanity. And so idolatry is not just a, God doesn't like it, he's going to judge you, but it runs against the very fabric of how God created us and how he wants us to be, because we become like the idols. Does that make sense? If you want to, this book literally is all about just making that one point. Any other thoughts there?
I'm thinking of the idol maker. And so this person, this is what he chooses to spend his time on earth doing.
Yeah.
We have limited time on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do that, I guess it seems like you're compounding the problem.
Yeah.
Not only are you worshiping, but you're enabling other people to do the same thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
Basically wasting their time or their lives worshiping something that's not true.
Interesting point. That's a great, my question as you say that is, how do we do that today? Like, who's the modern idol maker, right? And we probably look at people in culture, like, you know, some of these financial influencers that are out there that are just like constantly talking about getting to the next level and all that. They might be analogous to what you're describing, the idol makers of our day that sort of keep pushing towards these things that are not ultimate as the place of, you got to get there, you got to do that. And sort of.
It's become so acceptable in culture now, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you have TV programs called American Idol.
Yeah. Yeah.
Recognizing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say, you know, movie makers, producers, things like that are all in the business of creating idols, people that are musicians.
Yeah. I remember my mom watching Canadian Idol, the spinoff of American Idol, one time. And I don't even know how old, but being mortified that there was this show called, and my mom was watching it. Then she explained to me, and then I started watching with her. I was like, oh, this is cool. You're right. We get so used to sort of some of those things that just kind of takes the edge off the seriousness of idolatry. Not that it's wrong to call a show American Idol. I'm not saying that's inherently problematic, but it does speak to our propensity to elevate something to worship, right? Another result of idolatry comes in Jonah's prayer as he's sinking down. He says this, those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their hope of steadfast love. If nothing else, by worshiping an idol, your hope is gone. Your security is gone. You're not worshiping the sovereign God, you're worshiping someone else. Galatians, we're going to skip over that one, but it talks about people who have come to faith were enslaved by idols. That's the reality there. How does the New Testament handle idolatry? We've been in the Old Testament. I'm using the term, it becomes a little bit more metaphorical. People aren't worshiping idols quite in the same way, although that isn't altogether true, right? There are plenty of idol worshipers, temples with idols in the book of Acts. But there is a bit of an expansion, not necessarily changing the term, but showing what's always been there more fully. We see this in places like Colossians, where Paul gives a list of sins, and then he says, and greed, which is idolatry, right? Which is a really helpful way of beginning to understand how expansive idolatry is, right? It is inclusive of things like greed, right? And that's gets at that, you know, accumulation mindset of I want more, 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 taking the place of God. That is idolatry. Romans 1:23 gives us that they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshiped and served created things rather than the Creator, who is forever praised. Amen. Right? And so that's the piecing it together. It's all of these activities, these behaviors that put something in the place of God. Those things are always from the creation. And interestingly enough, this isn't just this. This is where, you know, I said New Testament, but we got an Old Testament passage here. This is a very helpful little verse that on idolatry from Ezekiel. Ezekiel 14, there's some idolatrous elders that are confronted in this passage. This is what it says in verse 1. Then certain of the elders of Israel came to me and sat before me. And the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, these men have taken their idols into their hearts and set the stumbling block of their iniquity before their faces. Should I indeed let myself be consulted by them? All right, and then they're condemned in the rest of that passage. But the language there in verse 3 of they took their idols into their heart, I think is really helpful. It reminds us that idolatry is not just this outward behavior, but it's an inward elevation of things into their very affections, into their heart. And we see them doing that there. So what does the New Testament tell us to do about idolatry? Well, it says we are to flee idolatry. And there's several examples here. This is the logic of a lot of 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. And so they had, obviously, these Corinthians were engaged in idolatry, but they're told to flee from it. Usually you're told to flee from something that is dangerous, that also has a tendency to want to grab you back. It's not going to want to let you go. 1 John 5:21. What's interesting about the book of 1 John is it has not been dominantly about idolatry. And then this, you know, John's writing it near the end of his life. It's very pastoral, all these sorts of things. And he says, little children, keep yourself from idols. And just sort of, it's just sort of dropped in there. I'll never forget, it's probably 9 years ago. The gentleman who gave this lecture was in his 80s then. He's still alive, so he's early 90s now. He was a retired New Testament professor from New York who was a member of our church. And he was speaking at a men's event, and he did a whole like 30 minutes just on that verse. Little children, keep yourself from idols. And it struck really poignantly as this almost 85-year-old guy was reflecting back on his life, a life that had been, by all accounts, very pious, very religious. And he was talking about his own sort of desires towards idolatry. And it was just really convicting to hear somebody in that demographic with that sort of life remind ourselves that keep yourself from idols. This matters is sort of the point there. And there's some of the idolaters are excluded from inheriting God's kingdom. And then Acts 15:20 gives this picture of sort of being a requirement of being part of God's people, that they would do this. And really, I know I should have made the font bigger, but on the bottom here, it gives four verses there from 1 Peter, 1 Thessalonians, and 1 Corinthians that really define idolaters as those outside the church. It's this marker, right? There's the pagan idolaters, and then there's us, right? But we keep being warned not to go back towards that that behavior and that way of life. Thoughts on all of this?
Well, in that 1 John about following anyone or anything, I'm thinking about very influential. Today we have the influencers, mm-hmm. and so we're drawn to that. Mm-hmm. So I just think it's interesting. I mean, God created us, he knows mm-hmm. our weaknesses, and
for sure.
It seems to that idolatry is something that ultimately exists in your mind.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
But there are like influencers,
mm-hmm.
or if you take it even further, I was thinking about what you said about how Christians can think that, you know, worshiping a piece of wood or a piece of stone is stupid,
mm-hmm.
and ridiculous, and mm-hmm. yet it has power,
mm-hmm.
and that power is what exists in our, what we make of it in our own mind. But when you have real people, or even I was thinking about Satan himself,
mm-hmm.
some people choose to worship Satan,
yep.
knowing that, you know, they could worship the living God mm-hmm. here, or they could worship Satan mm-hmm. and his lies. But Satan is a real entity
yeah.
that exists. So
yeah.
can Satan be an idol, or can other people
yeah.
be idols, or does it go back yeah. to the same idea that what you're worshiping it exists in your own mind?
I think it goes back to that same idea. I mean, there's another aspect of the whole conversation going back to your angels and demons class, right? Like, what degree of demonic activity is behind these idols in the Old Testament, right? There's some verses and places that we could draw some connections, but it's not only that. I think it has to include the other categories that you're describing there, of it being sort of just our own, it's our own sin. We can be idolaters without Satan, right? We don't need him to kind of be part of the equation, although sometimes he is through temptation and other things. But yeah, so yeah, Satan could be an idol because he's taking the place of God.
Looking at the First John passage, mm-hmm. about revering and following him, like
mm-hmm.
Thinking, bringing it closer to home. I think within the church, we even have
mm-hmm.
yeah, superstars
yeah.
that are revered and mm-hmm. followed, and
yep.
then they fall.
Yep.
It really hurts
yep.
the church, because yep. everyone's in high. I was believing in him, I was following what his teaching was,
yeah.
and all of a sudden I found out he's human.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. People who have busts of all the different theologians in their offices, and like, I like to make fun of them and say they got all their little idols yeah. ready to go. And it's tongue-in-cheek, but there is an edge there that I think that we need to be cognizant of, right?
Well, and there's the theology of the big R, too.
Yeah.
Danger reform, the big R.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you're yeah. not doing the big R,
then we're not. Yeah.
Then we're not.
And you talk about revering things. I'm not going to mention the book, but I read a biography of somebody that most of us, everybody in this room knows, and most of us probably respect very highly. We'll leave it at that. Read a biography of him, and it was basically a hagiography, which is like a book of like how great somebody is, like a sainthood kind of book. And it was just one of those things where it's like, yeah, there's some, and the guy's great. We've all benefited from him.
Yeah.
But there can be this part where it's like, are we, what are we attracted to? Is it God or those sorts of things? So, and those are the things I wouldn't like, just labeling that as like, oh, you're an idolater. That can be a little heavy handed, but to say, hey, look at your heart and how you want to worship something. And, you know, where are things bringing you towards Jesus, and where are they bringing you towards somebody else? All right, quickly as we wrap up, I'll skip over that quote. Basically, idolatry is drinking salt water. Couple quick points of application. We become what we worship. We saw that in Psalm 115. Are you becoming deaf and blind by your idolatry? By that, I mean, have you elevated family, comfort, finances, whatever it is, to a place that is numbing you in some sense to the fullness of who God is and who he's calling you to be? And I think we would all say, yes, that is happening. So we become what we worship. Humility, we all struggle. It's not merely against God's will. It malforms his creatures away from imaging him. We have always worshiped poorly. That comes, he says it a little bit differently. It comes from this Jewish scholar. No, sorry, not this guy. This, I don't have the book. It's another book. William T. Kavanaugh says that. I think his term is we always worship badly. And his point is basically, look at church history. We have a propensity to be idolaters. So don't fool yourself. You are too, right? You're not, this generation hasn't finally sort of sinned like, huh, let's be critical of idolatry. It's like, no, it's pernicious. We kind of all do that. And then we'll talk about this more probably in our last week together on this class. But Christ dislodges idols. That is the answer. What dislodges idolatry? It is seeing the supremacy of Christ, his glory and his goodness, and seeing him for who he is. And as we look at him, then we long for that and communion with him and not our idols. So if you're tempted toward idolatry, it is to run towards Christ. And all this really connects, I mean, back to Westminster Confession 1:1, Shorter Catechism 1, sorry, not, got the wrong reference. We are created to worship God, to glorify him and enjoy him, right? That's our purpose. That's where we find our joy, is in doing that. And idolatry constantly comes and says, no, do this, because it somehow will fulfill you. It'll somehow look better. So we need to remind ourselves that God created us. Our purpose is to image him. And where we see that most fully is in representing Christ. And Christ has joined us to himself so that it can actually be a real reality. So keep trucking. In weeks ahead, we're going to look at more specific idols, like examine them. And then we will talk more about how do we actually identify them and dislodge them in our lives. So let's pray. Father God, thank you for your word. Lord, would you convict us of our idolatry, and would you point us to the hope of Christ? We ask in his name alone. Amen.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, guys.